Welcome back to Daft on Draft, and I'm going to start this off with an apology. We said this would not be a good week of college football. We were about as wrong as we could be. We said that it was going to be boring. The matchups were not fantastic, and then we had, was it six ranked teams lose this week?
Yeah.
And in convincing fashion for a couple of them, it was a fantastic week of college football from top to bottom. And I think when you're looking at it, like the Alabama game, like weird bounce for the Jalen Milroe interception, but like he played pretty well in that football game overall. Like Vandy is just kind of a good football team all of a sudden. We'll get into more of this when we get to Daft or Draft. But I need to ask Corey, what games really caught your attention this weekend? I know that, you know, you have two small children, so your weekends might be a little bit busier than the average college football fan. Two very small children.
Yeah.
But were you able to sit down and watch any of this madness?
I was. I wasn't able to stay up and watch the Miami-Cal game, which I really wanted to. For the sake of what's Cal
awesome,
Twitter.
What's awesome about my time is...
I know. It's like so brunch for you. Yeah.
It's so unfortunate because Pac-12 After Dark was perfect for me to wake up and watch football on my Sunday morning. But having ACC After Dark, it feels a little bit weird.
It does. That reminds me of my time in Seattle. I lived in Seattle for a year after I graduated from college and did a gap year in Seattle, started grad school out there before I transferred back home. But that reminds me of, like, I would go to Browns backers bars and watch the games at 10 a.m. because it was like 3 hours ahead of time. So I'd be eating French toast and drinking coffee watching Browns games. It was some of the best experiences of my life. But really the games I caught, again, we've been calling this Missouri thing for a while. That, like,
yeah,
Missouri's been getting the benefit of the doubt ranking-wise because they have experience all over the field. And I think they finally got outclassed talent-wise against Texas A&M. And they finally, I mean, they got beat bad. I mean, they got hammered in this game. So that was a game that I caught the full game.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
If they don't pick up that flag on the first drive, do you think that this game flow looks entirely different?
Maybe, but like 31 points isn't just like a momentum. You know what I'm saying? Like 31 points. Flag isn't.
I agree, but that entire team after that moment looked defeated. Like Luther Burden came off the field and was not happy.
Yeah.
So I do think that it could have been a little bit of a blow in that moment that kind of just spiraled out of control. Because we also have to remember, these are college kids.
Mm-hmm.
And college kids are still, some of them, teenagers. So you need to sit back and think about where you were when you were 18, 19, 20 years old and how you reacted to adversity. They're not going to react perfectly every single time to adversity. So I do think that there is a little bit of that in college football, just in general. And even at the NFL level, we see teams that are outclassed beat other teams even for weeks and weeks and weeks at times. You know, the Arizona Cardinals a couple of years ago, they had a top six defense in the NFL in terms of EPA. And you looked at their roster and it was literally just Buda Baker. Nobody else was good on that defense. And so you can have these runs in these small sample sizes. But I do think when we sat down and we watched that football game, Texas A&M recruits more. They recruit better. They have the talent. And they had
that oil money
on that day, the much, much better quarterback play because Brady is cooked. Somebody tweeted that out. I think it was Matt Lane, who covers the Kansas City Chiefs a little bit and is a local to that area. He said Brady cooked. And yes, Brady is cooked, unfortunately,
for
that Missouri team.
His pocket presence is unbelievably poor for a four-man rush. Like to
11 for 35 in that game. It was ugly.
He's jittery against four-man fronts. Like, mm-hmm. And against Texas A&M's four-man fronts, Shamar Turner, Nick Scorton. You know, Nick Scorton had a welcome back game in this one as well. So that's good for him. But yeah, Brady Cook's pocket awareness was not great in this one. And you know, I'm going to hold out talking about a little bit of that game till we get to a little bit of helmet stickers as well. But my flag is back up for a certain player as well. It's back up a little bit, of course. A little bit.
And ask me.
Yeah, but as far as the rest of the schedule goes, I do have two really small kids. So, you know, I could sometimes turn on the games here and there, but I did make sure to catch the end of that Vandy and Bama game. My goodness, what? College football needs a good anti-hero, is what I would call Diego Pavia, an anti-hero. Yeah. Like, he's not a good guy. He's not a bad guy. But he has the same intentions of the good guys, even if his way, if his means of getting there are a little rough around the edges, I guess you could say, whether that's urinating on your rival's logo or in the Auburn game where they upset Auburn last year at New Mexico State, body slamming a DB after throwing a pick or dropping F-bombs in post-game interviews. I think college football needs a good anti-hero, and I think Diego Pavia could go down as one of the more fun college quarterbacks to ever play college football this season. Like, you just have those guys that you know, this guy's probably doesn't have an NFL future, but like, college gamers are so fun. Like Todd Reesing at Kansas back in the day, like, give me a college gamer. And Diego Pavia is like the penultimate anti-hero of college football right now. And I love it. I love it. So that game was a lot of fun to see all the stuff that happened with Vanderbilt. And then after that as well, like literally carrying the goalpost out of the stadium down Broadway and throwing it into the river. It's like the most unbelievable college football pageantry thing you could think of after an upset. Just like they took it right out of the stadium and threw it in a river. It's amazing. Yep. It's college football.
It is amazing. It is amazing. And we're going to talk about some more amazing things. Two amazing things specifically for this DAFT or draft. DAFT or draft, Corey, Travis Hunter and Ashton Jeanty should be the only two legitimate Heisman candidates at this point.
Yeah. Should be or will be. Should be. I'm going to draft they should be.
Okay. Will be.
No, I'm going to DAFT that one because quarterbacks always get the benefit of the doubt. And Cam Ward, for better or for worse, has had a couple Heisman moments in back-to-back weeks now. And college football is more about pageantry than it is substance to some extent. And Cam Ward is pouring on the honey to his own Heisman run right now. Again, he's in these holes that Miami is getting into are largely due to Cam Ward's quarterback play, for better or for worse. Like, there's some defensive lapses as well, of course, but like,
for sure.
For the most part, like, Cam Ward is contributing to his own deficits in these past 2 weeks. But he's also one of the sole reasons they're being pulled out of these deficits as well. And those are Heisman moments. Those are Heisman moments where you come back 25 down in the fourth quarter. Like, that's a Heisman moment. You're throwing for four bills a week. That's Heisman worthy. So I think that there's a pageantry element to Cam Ward that, no, Jeanty and Hunter aren't the only two Heisman contenders right now, even if they should be off of a film and substance perspective, where, I mean, Jeanty's putting up probably the best college football season we've ever seen right now from a running back. Like, he's got 1,000 yards on less than 100 carries. That's absolutely ridiculous. In five games, on 90 carries, he had 1,000 yards. That's over 10 yards per carry for those who find
you can't do that on NCAA. Yeah.
No, you can't do that on a video game unless you're playing on freshman. Like, can't do that.
I don't even know if you could get 10 plus yards of carry playing on freshman.
That's fair. And then Hunter's just the best player in college football. Like that.
Well, not just, and I need to be crystal clear about this as well. He is playing over 100 snaps a game on average. Travis Hunter is doing something that we've never seen before. Yes. Jeanty is too. And that's what we really need to sit down and discuss here. We are seeing two guys do something that we have never, ever seen done before. Yes, Cam Ward is playing on a top five team in the nation, and he is the sole reason why they were able to come back and win the past two games. Yes, He also helped contribute to those deficits in the first half of those games, or in the early in the second half of this game as well. But he is the reason why that offense is able to come back and survive. And Xavier Restrepo, just shout out.
Yeah.
That is the next, and I hate to say this, but like slot receiver, like he's the next Wes Welker. Like he's the guy who you can just absolutely count on no matter what. That dude is tough as nails. Really, really fun player.
Yeah.
But when I watch what GNT and Hunter are doing, it's unbelievable. I've never seen a running season like this before. And I was old enough to remember AD when he was at Oklahoma. I mean, that was a man possessed. And although he's not doing it, Ashton's not doing it against the Big 12. I mean, the Big 12 is still fake football. It was back then too. But when I look at what he did against Oregon and what he has been doing this entire season, I've never seen anything like it. The way that he breaks tackles, he is a grown man out there. Mm-hmm. But man, Hunter, he's the best receiver on the team. He's the best corner potentially in the nation. Mm-hmm. He's one of the most productive wide receivers in college football. He is what they have offensively. They try to get him the ball damn near every single snap. He is that Colorado team.
And he's one of the most productive defensive backs in the nation too.
Yes.
He's like the ball production is there as well.
And he's got the best hands, some of the best hands in college football. Receiver, corner, doesn't matter. His hands are insane. He reached up and elevated for a pass in this past game that I went back and watched because I was watching a little bit of Shador as well. And listen, Shador might be QB1. He might be the first quarterback drafted. Mm-hmm. And that player is not the most valuable player on your college football team. Travis Hunter is. That is how special of a player we are talking about right now. So I think those two should be the only two. And I think by the end of the year, if they even keep up half of this pace, and I do question it because I question whether or not Hunter will be able to remain healthy playing 100-plus snaps a game. That is a lot to a big, heavy toll to put on your body, even at the college level. If GT ends up with 2,000-plus,
it's got to be GT. Which
seems like it's going to happen at this point. If he goes for 200-plus bills a game, I find it difficult to give it to anybody else because we are talking about a historic college football season where we are not going to get that from any of these quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. We're not getting the Joe Burrow year. We're not getting the Cam Newton year this year. Yeah. These guys deserve it.
Yeah. It's pretty similar to like Devontae Smith in 2020. Like Devontae Smith in 2020 was so undeniable that they could not give that award to a quarterback. They could not, like, so undeniable and so productive, like week in, week out at Bama in the SEC, that like they couldn't justify giving the Heisman to anybody other than a wide receiver and other than Devontae Smith. And again, the Janty level of competition thing is can be a talking point if we want to make it a talking point, but like just very easily point to the Oregon game, and Oregon's defensive front is probably the best unit on that football team. Like Jordan Burge is a really good player. Harmon, their defensive tackle, is getting a lot for a first round buzz right now because he's had a really good start to the season. Like that Oregon front is not a bad, like it's one of the better fronts in the nation too. So like he did that. He dropped two bills on Oregon, man. Like, so I think what Janty's doing is similar to what Devontae Smith did in 2020, where it's like, this is undeniable that we can't give this award to anybody other than this player.
Yep.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
I think that's how it'll be too. I think that's how it should be. Mm-hmm. Speaking of how it should be, our next after draft, Week 6 of the college football season, all of the upsets, all of the insanity is the new norm for college football.
Draft. I'm drafting this so hard. Like I am so excited about this too. Like we can talk about NIL and the transfer portal killing college football, but I think it's making it so fun. Like it's making it so unpredictable. It's making it so fun because like I think Indiana is the perfect example of this. I think Florida State was a pretty decent example last year. Maybe Michigan State with Kenneth Walker a couple of years ago.
And Florida State might be a good example on the opposite end of it this year.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Is like there's going to be different teams every year that make some run because look at Indiana's roster. They transferred in a sixth-year quarterback. They transferred in a bunch of James Madison fifth-year seniors who are like graduate transfers, who came with Kurt Cignetti from James Madison to IU. Mm-hmm. Like all of the guys that they brought in from the transfer portal are all just going to be one-year wonders at the Big Ten level. And then IU, who knows what they're going to be next year, but they're really fun this year because they transferred in all of these seniors and all these guys who experienced with their new head coach who have played with that head coach. And like IU has a gauntlet ahead, but if you tell me IU goes 4-1 and only lose to Ohio State in their next five games, that's a playoff team in my mind. Like they legitimately have a shot to be a top 12 team in the nation by the end of the season because of this. And kind of the same thing with Florida State. Like it's no secret that Florida State recruits the portal like crazy, but that can be a give and take though, because like you have to have a head coach that can build chemistry and continuity in a heartbeat. If you are pulling 70% of your starters out of the portal every year, you have to have a coach that can build that into a team in a very short span. When you have that much just turnover year after year after year. And with Florida State, Mike Norvell, maybe this is a fluke year. Maybe it's not. Maybe they just got the wrong quarterback and that's kind of spiraled the whole team. But on paper, they were talked about as the best defensive line in the nation. That defensive line stinks. So like, that's going to make it so unpredictable because on paper, you can say this team looks really good and then they don't mesh on the field because they've never played together. Or yeah. You can say all of these guys played together here and they're playing together here. In IU's case, from James Madison to Indiana, they all came with them. And they're playing really good football in the Big Ten, which in my mind is not playing great football. Like if you told me IU is going to beat Washington and Michigan over the next two weeks, I could say, yeah, I could see those two teams could not score IU. I could see where those two teams can't outscore IU. And so that makes it so much fun. And that's what's going to make it unpredictable. Again, next year IU, they might go back to winning four games after all these dudes graduate that they brought in for 1 year. But for this year, it's fun and it's unpredictable and it gives college football parity. Who's going to be that team next year? And I think
this one season help kickstart the actual high school recruiting process as well?
Yeah. If coach quarterbacks are seeing Cignetti's putting up 40 points a game in the Big Ten with a sixth year senior from the MAC, like who's from like a Canadian quarterback from the MAC, like, yeah, like that's a lot of fun, man. So, I love the amount of parity. Like Vanderbilt brought in an absolute gamer. We've already talked a little bit about Diego Pavia, but an absolute gamer from New Mexico State, and he leads an upset over number one Alabama. Like Vanderbilt is the punching bag of the SEC. Like that's just
always
they should be playing in the SEC, except in basketball and baseball. So I guess that's kind of why football gets kind of tossed to the wayside there because they just get bullied in football. But it's just so fun. It's so unpredictable. You never know. So yeah, I love it. I'm drafting that so hard.
I would love to draft it. I hope that it is the new reality. And with all of the, I mean, and we've talked about it with the Big 12 and Kansas State and Arizona and all those teams just cannibalizing each other. And I honestly think like we're going to start seeing three lost teams get into the playoffs eventually. And that's, you know, the problem with the 12 team playoff in general is there's just not that many good teams in college football, and it will be interesting to see how it all kind of shakes out over time. But I love that we can go into a week like that and say, yeah, these matchups kind of stink, and it goes absolutely insane on us. So a lot of fun. I mean, Cal almost beat Miami, probably should have beat Miami. I mean, it's all so much fun. And the other thing that we have to talk about and that I don't think is talked about enough is Miami having to go to Cal in the first place because conferences have always been so regional. Some of these college kids that went to Miami are from Florida or from Alabama or from Georgia, have probably never been to the West Coast. So the 5.5 hour flight and 3 hour time difference is a huge, huge hit to them. Makes things really difficult. Jet lag is a real thing. Mm-hmm. Playing that late at night when you're not used to it is different. And that the lack of regionality at this point creates a whole other bit of weirdness to what is already a weird college football. I'm very excited about this. Yeah. I was not happy about the lack of regional football anymore. I was not happy about that when the conferences all realigned. But the more I think about it, the more I see it, the happier I am about it. Because then you do have kids from Arizona trying to go and play in K-State and getting mollywopped. And then, you know, you'll see a good team go over to them, a ranked football team go over to them and get destroyed because they've never played on the West Coast. It's just,
yeah.
And that's not the only reason. It's just because these teams and these college kids are unpredictable. It's like the college kickers thing.
Yeah.
You can't trust college kickers. You can't trust college kids.
No. And this is, again, we've talked about IU a little bit already, but and UCLA is not a very good football team, but what a culture shock for UCLA to go to Bloomington, Indiana and get their asses kicked.
Yeah.
Like that's a conference game. Like they had to go from LA to Bloomington, Indiana to the cornfields and they just got their asses handed to them. Like it's kind of beautiful. How can you not be romantic about it? Dalton, we didn't talk about this off the air, but I just thought of another Dafter draft that I'm going to spring on you right here. So I'm looking at both these teams' schedules and they each only have one ranked opponent left and it's the same opponent, which they'll both probably lose that game. They're both undefeated. You're a serviceman yourself. Dafter draft, the Army-Navy game will be to determine an at-large bid for the college football playoff.
Oh, you know, I kind of would love it because I kind of love Navy this year. And I hate to say as an Army man myself, I didn't go to West Point, ladies and gentlemen. I was an enlisted in the Army. But no, that Navy team is a lot of fun. I would love that for that to be the reality, especially because they're not just a triple option football team anymore. They can throw it. And so it would be fun. I do think that they would get absolutely mollywopped in the playoffs because at the end of the day, they have fitness regulations that they have to abide by. They don't have 330-pound dudes on that football team. Right. So it would be interesting to see. I think it's just more of a fun regular season story.
Yeah, I do too. They both play Notre Dame though. So at different points down the backstretch here. So that'll be fun to see how they handle Notre Dame in those games. But all right, should we dive into some helmet stickers?
Let's do it. We've already been on here for 22 minutes, so we got to be kind of quick.
All right, so helmet stickers again. Three players from each of us talking about standouts from week 6 now. Dalton, I'll let you go first. Who is your first helmet sticker? And again, 2025 draft eligible players as well.
We need to point out.
No Ashton Jancy, no Harold Fannin Jr., no Travis Hunter. We could give Harold Fannin Jr. dropped the buck 30 again. Ashton Jancy dropped 2 bills again. Travis Hunter didn't play this week.
Didn't play, but they would probably be still on could it
win one, yeah.
Every single week, yes. my first is Arkansas defensive end, outside linebacker, whatever you want to call him. He's 280 pounds, so I imagine he'll be a defensive end at the NFL level. Landon Jackson, who has an NIL deal with the WWE, by the way. He is part of their like junior division. I think that he is a big wrestling fan. And what I like is that he brings some of that pageantry and I don't want to say actor role, but like the creativity of an actor to his pass rush ability. He's somebody who at 280 pounds, at 6'7", you would think, all right, he's probably like an AJ Epenesa type, right? Like he wins through the chest. It's a lot of speed to power. He's a good run defender. No. This is a guy who plays a little bit more finesse than I would like for being a 270 pounder, but he is also like a legitimate 6'6". I think he is a little bit shorter than his listed height, but 6'5", 6'6", 270 pounds with legitimate bend on the outside. Now, he's not like as explosive as Myles Garrett or anything like that, but we are in the era of the freakishly sized defensive end outside linebacker types. And I keep saying outside linebacker types because they dropped him into coverage quite a bit last year. They only did it one time in this past game, but he has the athletic ability to survive in the flats or in the hook. Like that's how good of an athlete he is. At 6'7", 270. And he had a really good game this week. Now, there's still issues with him playing a little bit high because just naturally he is going to lose a little bit of leverage at times. But he does a really good job of utilizing his freakish length to his advantage quite a bit. When he does get the ability to play through the chest, stack and shed is there. So he does and can be a playmaker in the run game as well. But his pass rush repertoire is really, really good. He can win inside. He can win outside. Like I said, he has been. He has a really nice like floating wipe cross chop that he has as well to capture the edge. He beat the offensive tackle and a tight end that was trying to chip him on one play. He didn't get home on that play. The quarterback rolled out right. But he was really, really dominant in this football game. He ended up having 7 total pressures. He had the 1 sack and he had the 3 defensive stops. Just somebody who I was really high on coming into last year. Started off this season anonymous. And then really started to turn it on as they've gotten into SEC play.
I love it. I'm going to stick on the defensive line to start then too. You know, I have a defensive and edge rusher on my list as well. And coming into the season, those Ohio State edge rushers got a ton of pre-draft hype. And I wasn't there with either JTT nor Jack Sawyer. Like, one, I don't see a lot of overall athleticism with JTT. I think he's a well-rounded player who does a lot, a little bit, but doesn't have like a dominant trait. And then Jack Sawyer, I thought, you know, and I still do think he's stiff as a board and can really only win through the chest and with power. He's not going to win on the outside track a lot, but I think that's okay as long as you can win consistently with power. And he did in the Iowa game, man. Like, he worked through the chest of an Iowa offensive line that has been able to move the football on everybody they've played this year so far, especially on the ground. Caleb Johnson has been phenomenal for them. And up until he broke a long run in the fourth quarter, he was averaging below 4 yards a carry in that game. So, but in this, the game, the 35-7 win against Iowa, Jack Sawyer finished with 5 pressures, 2 sacks, 2 quarterback hits, 1 quarterback hurry, and 2 stop tackles as well. So, and he forced a fumble. So he stacked the stat sheet in this one against Iowa. Again, ultimately, I think Jack Sawyer is probably a day 2 pick. He might hear his name called in the second round. I don't see the bend. I don't see the hip flexibility to be a first round pick at the edge rusher position from Jack Sawyer. But especially with Ohio State not playing anybody really for the first 3 games, Michigan State kind of, but like, who can you tell as a draftable prospect from Michigan State this year? Like, nobody pops to the top of my mind. So for him to go then against Iowa, who has been moving the football consistently and does have a kind of a physical brand of offensive linemen to do that against Iowa, kind of stood out to me. So Jack Sawyer is going to get a helmet sticker from me here.
Who is your second helmet sticker?
Yeah, let's go to the offensive trenches. I'm going to save the best for last in this one. I'm going to milk this one. So I'm going to go to the offensive trenches, and it's a player who not only had a clean slate as a pass rusher in this game, but hasn't given up a pressure all season long. And I'm going to go with West Virginia's offensive tackle, Wyatt Millam. Ultimately, as we've talked about in this tackle class, a guy who I think is a guard at the NFL level, because I don't see the foot speed with Wyatt Millam. I think he's very well balanced and he's very consistent, which is what you want, but I don't see those tools to be able to hang with the Miles Garrett, the Micah Parsons, the NFL quality edge rushers in his physical tool set. But again, he has not a lot of pressure, and we're 3 games into Big 12 play now. I guess they play Pitt. Pitt is ACC. But he's played Penn State. Abdul Carter didn't have a pressure against him. He's played Pitt. He's played Kansas. He's played Oklahoma State now. So we're getting into they've played Albany as well. But 4 of his opponents have been P4 opponents, and he hasn't given up a pressure the entire season. In this game against Oklahoma State, which they won in convincing fashion against Oklahoma State, who's starting a 7th-year senior quarterback, by the way. But he had 25 pass sets and didn't get a single pressure in this game. So Wyatt Millam, we're noticing that you have not given up the pressure at all this whole season.
So. All year. And the database that I have says 32-inch arms. So just more convincing evidence that he will be a guard at the next level. But he will be playing at the next level. My second is somebody who I was not as high on coming into the season as an overall, like, overarching offensive weapon, wide receiver, tight end type. This is Syracuse tight end Oronde Gadsden II. He had a huge game against it was UNLV on Thursday night. And he ended up with, it says 10 receptions on 11 targets. He was targeted like 14 or 15 times, and there were balls batted down into line of scrimmage. But he had 142 yards. He averaged 14.2 yards per reception. He didn't have a touchdown in this game, but he was part of the drive that got them down to the goal line late in the game or in overtime. He ended up taking the ball all the way down to the 1-yard line, wasn't quite able to get it in. But somebody who, in this game specifically, they wanted to get the ball to, and they did it. They figured out ways to get him involved early on. They used him as a mismatch weapon all across the formation, motioning him to create space to operate versus zone coverages to get him opened up, to confuse what was trying to happen in that ULV defense. They also hit him at the line of scrimmage a couple of times, hit him on seams and crossing patterns off of play action. A little bit of a big play threat there. And for me, what I liked to see the most was the use of his frame and his ability to bend with a little bit of explosiveness, something that I didn't really see from him when I saw him earlier in the year and then dating back to his time more as a wide receiver at Syracuse in his freshman season. But he's using his frame a little bit. He's still not the best blocker in the world. They use him as an H-back. It's really funny because every single time he is aligned on the opposite side of the back, you know split zone is coming. Every single time I'm sitting here pointing like the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood meme from Dalton, I think is the character's name. I've never actually watched the movie yet. I need to. But really, really big game from him, and one that helps me see the vision for him as a mismatch weapon at the NFL level.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. There's a lot of H-backs in this class. A lot of H-backs in this class. So,
well, there's not many real tight ends anymore.
No, there aren't. You're right. If they can throw their body around a little bit, I'm going to love that dude. So another reason I love Harold Fannin is he'll throw his body around a little bit.
Yeah.
On top of all the crazy athletic explosive stuff that he does on the football field as well. But my last one, and I'm not fully back yet here. We're not fully back yet, but he's got a nice two-game stretch here where if he can rip it these next 2 weeks, including a game against LSU, I might be all the way back. But Connor Wigman, welcome back, man. After missing three games for Texas A&M, Connor Wigman returned to the starting lineup for Texas A&M and torched the number 6 team in the nation through the air in this one. He was 22 of 27, 276 yards passing. Didn't have a touchdown in this game, unfortunately, through the air, but Le'Veon Moss also torched him on the ground in this game, too. He could have gotten the helmet sticker in this game, too. But two big-time throws in this game as well for Connor Wigman, and he was just surgical. There was a third and long crosser where he just threaded the needle. The play before that, he dropped one in the bucket with some touch down the sideline that got called for pass interference. It hit his wide receiver in the hand, like probably 15, 20 yards down the field in the, like touched it in there. Just beautiful arc on the football where the defender held the receiver's other hand and it hit the one hand that the receiver had free. So he's doing some things again that had Dalton and I talking about him before the season started. And if it does turn out to be true that he had 100 degree fever in that Notre Dame game, which a game he vomited on the field in, so it's not unbelievable to think about that being true. But if he can come out again, they've got LSU in 2 weeks. If he can come out these next 2 weeks and continue to shred it a little bit here, again, my flag is raised. But again, ultimately, I think Wigman's probably going to be a return to school candidate just because an NFL team needs to see a full year of tape on his film or on his resume. And he still doesn't have that. And he can't get that this year. Like he's missed three games again this year. So unless he just goes out here and torches for 300 yards and three touchdowns a game, I think he's probably ultimately going back to school to prove he can stay healthy for a full season. But my flag is raised again for Connor Wigman.
I don't know how this is going to come up. I'm going to put this up as an overlay, but the people need to see one of the reasons I am picking my third guy for a helmet sticker here. And that is the Texas A&M cornerback, Will Lee. Oh my God. Nicknamed the blanket, sent a blanket to Theo Weiss. And if you take PFF's stuff at face value, targeted 5 times in this game, 0 catches. He had the most cornerbacky game I have ever seen in my entire life because Weiss had a big drop along the sideline. He, Will Lee, gave up on a play and then was able to recover somehow on a broken play. He thought it was over. It was like 5.5 seconds late. Cook tosses the ball downfield. It's a good pass, but he had the speed to recover and make the play on it. I tweeted that one out. But this is a dude who's out there dancing, talking smack after every single play. He did the seatbelt after the drop from Weiss. Like, it was the most cornerbacky game. He had a pass interference on a play that he intercepted the pass on along the sideline. That was his one penalty. And then on that first drive of the game,
he should have had a pass interference on that.
He should have had a hold and a defensive pass interference that they picked up. And that was probably the turning point in the entire game. There is no bigger cornerback energy than what I got from Will Lee III in this football game. It was the best viewing experience I have had so far this year. I love everything about this kid. He's 6'3". He's 190 pounds. He went from high school, where he was a first team honors in Missouri, but he, prior to Texas A&M, he was at one season at Iowa Western Community College. He transferred after that to Kansas State, where he played pretty well. He redshirted in 2021, Iowa Western in 2022, Kansas State in 2023, and now in 2024, he is one of the biggest reasons why the Texas A&M defense, and they have a great front line, great pass rushers. But in the secondary, he's playing as the boundary corner. He has a ton of responsibility on his plate as the boundary corner. They are able to put numbers to the field side because he is able to match up with guys at 6'3", with fluidity, with recovery speed. He's incredibly apt and adept at playing in trail and using his safety behind him. He is a smart zone coverage defender as well. This young man has it. He can play. I don't know how good he is yet because he is grabby. There's a little bit of Sauce Gardner to him. There's a little grabbiness to him. But man, one of the most entertaining college football performances I can remember in a long time from a corner.
This corner class is loaded. Mm-hmm. You could throw a stone and hit a cornerback in this class.
You could throw a stone and hit a 6'2" corner in this class. It's insane.
Yeah. So another one to add to the list. Just Will Lee, yep. Texas A&M. Again, so my helmet stickers again, Texas A&M, Connor Wigman, quarterback, Wyatt Millam, offensive lineman. I'll call him an offensive lineman for West Virginia. Yeah. And Jack Sawyer, defensive end from Ohio State.
Will Lee III from Texas A&M. We have Landon Jackson, the Arkansas edge rusher, and we have Oronde Gadsden II, the Syracuse tight end / offensive weapon.
Love it. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the Dapped on Draft podcast. We smashed Dapper Draft and helmet stickers into one episode here because the next two episodes, we usually do Dapper Draft on Wednesday. We're going to take the next two episodes to do a little first-round mock draft here. So we're going to do the first 16 picks on Wednesday, get to those second 16 picks on Thursday before we break down the Week 7 matchups on Friday. So there's a reason we squish these things into one. This episode's a little bit longer, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. But until tomorrow when we're doing this mock draft, this has been the Dapped on Draft podcast.